So we come now to the last chapter of Daniel. And it introduces us into a very important part of our understanding of theology. At that time, Michael, the great prince, the protector of your people, will arise. There'll be a time of anguish such as has never occurred since nations first came into existence. A typical line that's repeated all the way through the apocalyptic literature, but here it is. But at that time, your people will be delivered, everyone found written in the book. Now, many of those who sleep in the dust of the earth will awake. Some will live forever. Others will become everlasting objects of contempt and abhorrence. Those who are wise will shine like the brightness of the sky. Those who lead many to righteousness like the stars forever and ever. Remember Paul, maybe you remember in the Philippians, talks about the community being like stars shining in the heavens, etc. But you, Daniel, keep my words secret. That's why they haven't come out till 165 BC. They've been around, but now we're publishing them because God wants us to. But they've been there right since the time of this famous Daniel and the exile. You get it? Get what they're doing? Right. You keep the words of the book sealed till the time of the end. This is the time of the end. Many will apostatize, evil will increase. That's one of the texts here, many of those will wake, which indicates the beginning of an idea of the resurrection of the dead. Up till now, all the way through the prophetic literature, all the way through the Torah, etc., it was assumed that death is the end of human life. Not human existence, because we go into Sheol and we're shades, ghost-like things, but we don't have life, because life is communion with God, and that ends with death. So there's no life, but there's existence. Now they start to think, hey, wait a minute, there's more to that. There's a life beyond death. And you can, the logic of it is kind of, where it seems to have, you know how some ideas, they do explode into the common consciousness because of, I'm thinking of the time when I and we, everybody that was around, for the first time saw the earth from space, in this lovely blue globe. Well, surely that must have done something to the psyche of everybody, unknown or known or aware or not aware. And it makes war stupid. It makes the war, you know, it makes so much of what we're doing madness, really, and environmental pollution and greed and all this stuff. But not everyone's got it, but a lot of us got it. Or it's still there in the new archetype here somewhere pushing us to stuff. Well, here's the beginning, and at this time, what was happening was the persecution. People were dying, young people as well as old, dying because they're faithful to their faith. Well, in a world which thinks if you die young, God's punishing you, because that was their world, God's organizing. Well, why would God punish a young, faithful, pure person who was giving their life up for their faith? I mean, it had to do something to their theology, surely. We're slow to change theology. It sits there like a, you know, but surely to God, if you're in touch with life, you have to shift. Well, they started to shift. Not all, by any means. But this is the beginning, realizing that if God is faithful, the death of a young person cannot be punishment for sin, even their parents' sin or their grandparents' sin. Or that's how they used to escape from the logic. But they were starting to think, no, there's more. So there it is there. And I'm going to take you now for 20 minutes through the development of this idea through the Old Testament scriptures. I think it's important enough to do, so I'll withdraw from Daniel for a while, just have a look at it. The first and dominant idea throughout the Bible, the Older Testament, I like to call it, is that the dead are lifeless shades in Sheol, Hades. That's what they are. Here's some texts, Psalm 88. My soul is full of trouble. My life draws near to Sheol. I'm counted among those who go down to the pit. I'm like those who have no help, like those forsaken among the dead, like the slain that lie in the grave, like those you remember no more, for they are cut off from your hand. That was how they understood it. Psalm 115. The dead do not praise the Lord, nor do any that go down into silence. Isaiah 38. Sheol cannot thank you, the dead cannot praise you, those who go down to the pit cannot hope for your faithfulness. So, keep me alive, so you'll be praised. That's the logic. Sirach. Now, this is about the same time as the book of Daniel. Who will sing praises to the Most High in Hades? From the dead as from one who does not exist, thanksgiving has ceased. Okay, so I've given you some examples. I could give you dozens more. That's the general mentality. You're right on that? Now let's look at another little factor. At the same time, there was this longing for an enduring relationship with God, of course. Here's Psalm 16. My heart is glad, my soul rejoices, my body rests secure, for you do not give me up to Sheol. You're not making me die. You do not let your faithful one see the pit. You show me the path of life. In your presence there's fullness of joy. In your right hand are pleasures forevermore. That doesn't contradict what we just learned, but it shows you a kind of a longing to stay in communion with God. Psalm 49, God will ransom my soul from the power of Sheol. He will receive me. Doesn't mean I'm going to go down to Sheol and he's going to pull me out. It means he's going to stop me going there. He's going to keep me alive in communion with God. Psalm 73, I am continually with you. Your right hand holds me. You guide me with your counsel, and afterward you receive me with honor. Whom have I in heaven but you? There's nothing on earth that I desire other than you. My flesh and my heart may fail, but God is the strength of my heart and my portion forever. A third element is that they did have, not many, but these extraordinary stories of heroes from the past who were assumed alive into heaven. In other words, they didn't die. They're with God in how they picture that. Here's one, Enoch is the first of them. Hence, after this period, in the two centuries just before Jesus, and in the first two centuries after, there are, I've got volumes of them at home, piles of apocalypses written all over. And the really interesting one, or they're all a bit interesting, is the ones of Enoch. There's a lot of them. One Enoch, two Enoch, three Enoch, four Enoch. There's the Coptic Enoch, and there's etc. They're all over them. And Enoch was interesting because Enoch was taken into heaven. So if you want to know what's happening in heaven, Enoch's the one to guide you. So he's like Aeneas, you know, leading the people through the afterworld. So Enoch is the guide. And it's fascinating. It shows you their mentality. It's science fiction of the day or whatever it is. But it's about heaven, heaven and hell and judgment and all that. So Enoch, what did they say about him? In the Genesis chapter 5, Enoch walked with God. Then he was no more because God took him. That's all we know. Interesting. What happened? Now, in the New Testament, in Hebrews chapter 11, verse 5, referring back to that, the author adds the point, he did not experience death. Another interesting one is, and these are all legendary, of course, Elijah. Elijah didn't die either. Elijah, we're told in the second book of Kings, chapter 2, ascended in a whirlwind into heaven. Well, of course, it'd have to be a whirlwind for Elijah. Couldn't be anything. I mean, he was kind of Cecil B. DeMille, eat your heart out. I mean, this is the great Elijah. So he goes whoosh, into heaven. And you know the stuff we saw a bit of when we studied Malachi a few weeks ago, a month ago, whatever. And it comes into the New Testament too. When's Elijah going to come back, you know? Because he's whatever. And in the Book of Wisdom, Chapter 4, verse 10, written just before the time of Jesus, and so in the 1st century BC in Alexandria, we have this. There were some who pleased God and were loved by him, and while living among sinners were taken up. That's all it says. Now, obviously, he's talking about Enoch and Elijah, but there's also stories around about the assumption of Moses because they didn't know where he was buried and so on. So there's that mythical, is that the word, element. Then there comes this emerging belief in the resurrection of the dead. Chapter 37 of Ezekiel, it's a metaphor there. So it's not talking about personal resurrection or anything, but it's the dry bones. Do you happen to remember that? So they're all in the valley. It's Israel in exile, and then the wind, the ruach of God comes, and they put on sinews, and the whole nation. It's about the rising of the nation from the ashes, really, not personal resurrection. But there's the beginnings of something going on there. Then there's this quite extraordinary. Don't know what to make of it, really. In Isaiah 26, verse 14 and then verse 19, it's an apocalyptic text. When was it written? I don't know. I suspect it was written at this time, but that's only a suspicion because you've done enough to know that the scrolls keep getting reimagined alive. Well, this is what it says anyhow, and you can't place it with any certainty. The dead do not live. That's normal understanding. Shades do not rise because you've punished and destroyed them and wiped out all memory of them. That's verse 14. Then there's a bit more. Verse 19, however, says, your dead shall live. Their corpses shall rise. O dwellers in the dust, awake, sing for joy. For your dew is a radiant dew. The earth will give birth to those long dead. So, quite extraordinary poetry. What was in the mind of the author? Your guess is as good as mine. But somewhere there's something happening in the psyche. Then come the Syrian persecutions we've talked about already. 167, 164, those last. And then Daniel, we've just... At that time, your people, this is not Daniel, is it? This is Maccabees, isn't it? I put that too well there. Yeah, Daniel reads, I'll read Daniel again for you. Many of those who sleep in the dust of the earth will awake. Some will live forever. Others will become everlasting objects of contempt and abhorrence. Similarly, in the book of Maccabees, you've got, at that time your people will be delivered, everyone who is found written in the book. Many of those who sleep in the dust shall awake, some to everlasting life, and some to shame and everlasting contempt. So you can see in there the beginnings, surely, of heaven, hell, punishment, book of life, judgment, etc. So let's move back now to the last words of the book of Daniel. And then I'll be reading to you some stories from the Greek. The man clothed in linen raised his right hand and his left hand towards heaven. And I heard him swear, take an oath, by the one who lives forever, that it would be for a year, 2 years, and half a year. And that when the shattering of the power of the holy people comes to an end, all these things would be accomplished. So that's the end of the book of Daniel. But in the Greek Old Testament, we have some further stories, and I'll read them to you now. So you can just tuck yourself in quietly and listen to the story, and just, these are much more like the stories at the beginning. They're not, okay. So, when King Astyages was laid to rest with his ancestors, Cyrus the Persian succeeded to his kingdom. Daniel was a companion of the king and was the most honoured of all his friends. Now, the Babylonians had an idol called Bel. Every day they provided for it 12 bushels of choice flour and 40 sheep and 6 measures of wine. The king revered it and went every day to worship it. But Daniel worshipped his own God. So the king said to him, "Why don't you worship Bel?" "Because I don't revere idols made with hands," said Daniel, "but the living God who created heaven and earth and has dominion over all living creatures." The king said to him, "Do you not think that Bel is a living God? Do you not see how much he eats and drinks every day?" And Daniel did what you just did. He laughed. And he said, "Don't be deceived, O king, for this thing is only clay inside and bronze outside, and it never ate or drank anything." The king was angry, and he called the priests of Bel and said to them, "If you do not tell me who's eating these provisions, you shall die." I loved killing people, these people. "But if you prove that Bel is eating them, Daniel shall die." Wow. "Because he's spoken blasphemy against Bel." Daniel said to the king, "Let it be done as you've said." Now, there were 70 priests of Bel, with besides their wives and kids. So the king went with Daniel into the temple of Bel. The priests of Bel said, "See, we are now going outside. You yourself, O king, set out the food and prepare the wine and shut the door and seal it with your signet. When you return in the morning, if you do not find that Bel has eaten it all, we'll die. Otherwise, Daniel will, who's telling lies about us." Priests can get a bit like this, you know. They were unconcerned, for beneath the table they'd made a hidden entrance. Hello, hello. Through which they used to go in regularly and consume the provisions. After they'd gone out, the king set out the food for Bel. Then Daniel ordered his servants to bring ashes, and they scattered them throughout the whole temple in the presence of the king alone. Then they went out, shut the door, sealed it with the king's signet, and departed. During the night, the priests came as usual with their wives and children and ate and drank everything. Early in the morning, the king rose and came with Daniel. And the king said, "Are the seals unbroken, Daniel?" He said, "Yes, they're unbroken, O king." And he shouted in a loud voice, "You are great, O Bel. In you there is no deceit at all." Daniel laughed and restrained the king from going in. "Hello, hello, hello," he said. "Look at the floor. Notice whose footprints these are." The king said, "I see the footprints of men, women, and children." Then the king was enraged. He arrested the priests and the wives and children, showed him the secret doors, they showed him which they used to enter to consume what was on the table. The king put them to death and gave Bel over to Daniel, who destroyed it and his temple. So far, so good. It's obviously mocking the gods of these, whatever. Now, in that place there was a great snake, which the Babylonians revered. The king said to Daniel, "You cannot deny that this is a living God. I worship him." Or her, as the case may be. No, that's my bit. Daniel said, "I worship the Lord my God. He is the living God. But give me permission, O king, and I'll kill the snake without sword or club." The king said, "I give you permission." Daniel took some... No one can work out how this is done, by the way. The scholars and chemists and bloody whatever have got together, and even you, Dr. Lott, and they've worked out, I don't know what the heck he did here. Anyhow, this is what he did in the story. They took pitch, fat, hair, boiled them together, made cakes, and he fed them to the snake. Doesn't sound too appetizing. The snake ate them and burst open. Daniel said, "See what you've been worshipping?" Oh, right, so that's that. Now, a bit more. When the Babylonians heard about it, they were very indignant. And they conspired against the king, saying, "The king has become a Jew. He's destroyed Bel and killed the snake and slaughtered the priests." Going to the king, they said, "Hand Daniel over to us, or else we'll kill you and your household." The king saw they were pressing him hard, and under compulsion, he handed Daniel over to them. Sounds like Pilate, doesn't it? They threw Daniel into the lion's den. Hello, we've been through this before. And he was there for 6 days. There were 7 lions in the den, and every day they'd been given 2 human bodies and 2 sheep. But now they were given nothing so that they would devour Daniel. Now, the prophet Habakkuk. Isn't it nice to have him back again? The prophet Habakkuk was in Judea, and he had made a stew and had broken bread into a bowl and was going into the field to take it to the reapers. But the angel of the Lord said to Habakkuk, "Take the food that you have to Babylon, to Daniel in the lion's den." Habakkuk said, "Sir, I've never seen Babylon, and I don't know anything about the den." So the angel of the Lord took him by the crown of his head and carried him by his hair, and with the speed of wind, he set him down in Babylon right over the den. I don't know how Habakkuk felt about any of this. Then Habakkuk shouted, "Daniel, Daniel, take the food that God has sent you." Daniel said, "You've remembered me, O God, and you've not forsaken those who love you." So Daniel got up and ate, and the angel of God immediately returned Habakkuk to his own place. On the 7th day, the king came to mourn for Daniel. And when he came to the den, he looked in, and there sat Daniel, licking his chops. No, that's my bit. The king, but anyhow, you're allowed to improve on these texts. The king shouted with a loud voice, "You are great, O Lord." So another king becomes a convert. "You are great." It's no wonder there's anything left. "You are great, O Lord, the God of Daniel. There is no other beside you." Then he pulled Daniel out, and you can guess the rest, threw into the den those who had attempted his destruction, and they were instantly eaten before his eyes. So there's a few little stories from the past. Now there's one more that we read actually in one of the masses, and it's all very difficult. Do you want to hear about Susanna?
Yes.
Anyone here under 17? Okay. Now, this one, by the way, Daniel did this one as a boy in the, is it the Greek text? I've got to, I know it's in there somewhere. I think they put it right up the front, like this is the first one, chapter 1, before all the rest of the book of Daniel, because this is what he did as a boy and showed you what he was going to do as a man. You got it? So this is it. "There was a man living in Babylon whose name was Joachim. He married the daughter of Hilkiah named Susanna." Susanna, by the way, means lily in Hebrew. "A very beautiful woman and one who feared the Lord. Her parents were righteous and trained their daughter according to the law of Moses. Joachim was very rich had a fine garden adjoining his house. The Jews used to come to him because he was the most honoured of them all. That year, two elders from the people were appointed as judges. Concerning them, the Lord had said, "Wickedness came forth from Babylon, from elders who were judges who were supposed to govern the people." These men were frequently at Joachim's house, and all who had a case to be tried came to them there. When the people left at noon, Susanna would go into her husband's garden for a walk. Every day the two elders used to see her going in and walking about, and they began to lust after her. They suppressed their conscience and turned away their eyes from looking to heaven or remembering their duty to administer justice. Cherchez la femme. Both were overwhelmed with passion. You always blame the woman. It was her fault for all this. Both were overwhelmed. And that seems to be the way things go, doesn't it? Both were overwhelmed with passion for her, but they didn't tell each other of their distress, for they were ashamed to disclose their lustful desires to seduce her. Do you want me to continue? Is this all right?
Please.
Day after day, they watched eagerly to see her. One day, they said to each other, "Let's go home. It's time for lunch." So they both left, parted from each other, but turning back, they met again. They both had the same idea and hadn't got together. They met again, and when each pressed the other for the reason, they confessed their lust. Then, together, they arranged for a time when they could find her alone. Once, while they were watching for an opportune day, she went in as before with only two maids and wished to bathe in the garden. It was a hot day. No one was there except the two elders who'd hidden themselves and were watching her. She said to her maids, "Bring me olive oil and ointments and shut the garden doors so that I can bathe." They did as she told them. They shut the doors of the garden and went out by the side doors to bring in what they had been commanded. They didn't see the elders because they were hiding. When the maids had gone out, the two elders got up and ran to her, and they said, "Look, the garden doors are shut. No one can see us. We're burning with desire for you. Give your consent and lie with us. If you refuse, we'll testify against you that a young man was with you and that this is why you sent your maids away." Susanna groaned and said, "I'm completely trapped. If I do this, it will mean death for me. If I do not, I cannot escape your hands. I choose not to do it. I'll fall into your hands rather than sin in the sight of my Lord." Then Susanna cried out with a loud voice. The two elders shouted against her, and one of them ran and opened the garden doors. When the people in the house heard the shouting in the garden, they rushed in at the side door to see what had happened to her. And when the elders told their story, the servants felt very ashamed, for nothing like this had ever been said about Susanna. The next day, when the people gathered at the house of her husband Joachim, the two elders came in, full of their wicked plot to have Susanna put to death. And in the presence of the people, they said, "Send for Susanna, daughter of Hilkiah, the wife of Joachim." So they sent for her, and she came with her parents, her children, and all her relatives. Now Susanna was a woman of great refinement, beautiful in appearance, and she was veiled. The scoundrels ordered her to be unveiled so that they might feast their eyes on her beauty. Those who were with her and all who saw her were weeping. And unveiled, probably, you know, when you're caught in adultery, it probably means stripped. Then the two elders stood up before the people and laid their hands on their head. Through her tears, she looked up towards heaven and for her heart trusted in the Lord. The elders said, "While we were walking in the garden alone, this woman came in with her two maids, shut the garden doors, and dismissed the maids. Then a young man who was hiding there came to her and lay with her. We were in the corner of the garden. When we saw this wickedness, we ran to them. Although we saw them embracing, she couldn't hold the man because we couldn't hold him because he was stronger than we, and he opened the doors and got away. We did, however, seize this woman and asked who the young man was, but she wouldn't tell us. These things we testify. Because they were elders and judges, the assembly believed them and condemned her to death. Then Susanna cried out with a loud voice and said, O eternal God, you know what is secret. You are aware of all things before they come to be. You know that these men are giving false witness against me. And now I am to die, though I have done nothing of the wicked things they have charged against me. The Lord heard her cry. Just as she was being led off to execution, God stirred up the Holy Spirit of a young lad named Daniel. And he shouted with a loud voice, I want no part in shedding this woman's blood. Well, the people turned to him and asked, What is this you're saying? Taking his stand among them, he said, Are you such fools, you Israelites, as to condemn a daughter of Israel without examining and without learning the facts? Return to court. These men have given false evidence against her. So all the people hurried back. People are like sheep, aren't they? They'll do whatever. You know, God helps. We're hopeless when we're in a crowd. That's not in the Bible, but that's... So all the people hurried back, and the rest of the elders said to them, Come, sit among us and inform us, for God has given you the standing of an elder. Daniel said to them, Separate them far from each other, and I will examine them now. When they were separated from each other, he summoned one of them and said to him, You old relic of wicked days, your sins have now come home, which you've committed in the past, pronouncing unjust judgments, condemning the innocent, acquitting the guilty, though the Lord said you shall not put an innocent and righteous man to death. Now then, if you really saw this woman, tell me this. Under what tree did you see them being intimate with each other? Under a mastic tree, he said. Daniel said, Very well. This lie has cost you your head. For the angel of God has received the sentence from God and will immediately cut you in two. Then, putting him to one side, he ordered them to bring in the other. He said to him, You offspring of Canaan, not of Judah, beauty has beguiled you and lust has perverted your heart. This is how you've been treating the daughter of Israel, and they were intimate with you through fear. Daughters of Israel. But a daughter of Judah would not tolerate your wickedness. Now then, tell me, under what tree did you catch them being intimate with each other? And he said, Under an evergreen oak. And Daniel said to him, Very well, this lie has cost you your head. For the angel of God is waiting with his sword to split you in two so as to destroy you both. Then the whole assembly raised a great shout and blessed God, who saves those who hope in him. And they took action against the two elders, because out of their own mouths Daniel had convicted them of bearing false witness. They did to them as they had wickedly planned to do to their neighbour. An eye for an eye, a tooth for a tooth, etc. Acting in accordance with the law of Moses, they put them to death. Thus, innocent blood was spared that day. Hilkiah and his wife praised God for their daughter Susanna, and so did her husband Joachim and all her relatives, because she was found innocent of a shameful deed, and from that day onward, Daniel had a great reputation among the people. So there's some edifying stories to take home.
Daniel come to judgment.
Daniel means El is God, Dan is judge, E is I. So God is my judge is the name of this.
One wonders how he would have handled it if by some chance they had both guessed the
Well, that's what stories are all about, really. It's thank God you weren't there to advise the author.